Welcome to another edition of Garden Talk. Today, we welcome Bob Tomesch to the microphone. Bob, senior lecturer in the Department of Horticulture at the UW-Madison and with UW Extension as well, and always has some good answers for your gardening questions. And we can talk about vegetable seeds or vegetable gardening. We can talk about flowers. We can talk about trees. We can deal with the lawn. Bob, we can deal with pretty much
everything except the weather, you know?
everything except the weather. Give us a call with your questions at 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. And you can email us, too. That address is talk@wpr.org. There's a new publication series under development, Bob, with UW Urban Horticulture. I don't know if you know about it. It's called Wisconsin Garden Facts.
Yes.
And it's designed to be friendly or user friendly for home gardeners. Do you know anything about when that'll be coming out?
I don't know exactly, but what we want to do is have something that's downloadable for anybody with a home computer that is a one- or two-pager and that has the key information that the individual might need.
Yeah, so kind of a fact sheet.
Kind of a short fact sheet. We figure we're seeing that more and more computer usage. You know, over the years, it's been very interesting when I did the Master Gardener training, and I still do. But I would say 6 years ago, less than 30% of the people really had computer interaction, and now we're probably over 70%. And so The computer becomes a very important tool for gathering that type of information.
And once you have that computer, or you can go to the library and use the computer there, things actually become a lot – you know, you don't have to buy those. You can go online and look.
That's another something that's very usable, and other states have done this where you can do kind of a search. The only thing is when we come to pesticides or something like that, that might be in the recommendation. Each state has their certain regulations on that. And so that we're in those situations, you want to become state specific.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, callers online. So let's go to John in Milwaukee first. John, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi there. I'd like to put a raised bed vegetable garden in my yard. And I'm just wondering, what's the best material to use?
Well, I would go with the currently the green treated product or cedar, one or the other. The green treated product no longer has any arsenic or any of those types of things in it, although some people do say that when they rub the wood that they feel kind of a rash to develop, and that's an individual sensitivity. Some people even say the same thing about cedar because of the resins that are in there. But anything that'll last a fairly long period of time, work with the raised beds that are comfortable to work with. Most people will utilize beds that are about 4 feet wide so they can reach in from either side that 2 feet and do their planting. How high you place the bed, that's dependent on you. And some people just raise the bed enough to get it above the ground, provide good drainage and good plant growth. Some people that have some other handicaps will probably try to get something that's waist high, and they even have raised beds that are wheelchair accessible. So there's a lot of options there.
Great.
All right. Does that help
you? Thank you.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. 1-800-642-1234, our number for you to join in. And let's see. Let's go to Adolph in Hartford next. Adolph, hello.
Hello.
Thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
I have, I got a plant. Nobody seems to know what it is. It's like the fruit looks like a size of a golf ball. Or it's a climbing plant. But inside the golf ball, the size has berries like small blueberries. Like small blueberries, okay? On all the blue. Or it's a climbing plant. Climbing plant. And nobody seems to know what it is. I went to the DNR, I went to friends, I went to gardening, whatever. Nobody seems to know what it is.
Okay, next summer when it's just leafing out, take some digital pictures of both the flower would be helpful, or the leaves, or bring a sample into the extension office. And if what we'll do is they'll look at it. If they're not sure, we can take a look at it. There are some possibilities. There are that I'm just guessing now. There are some of the They call them porcelain plant, which might fall into that category. Mm-hmm. It's hard to tell unless we really see the plant.
In the fall, it looks like when this like a berry type, you know, when it's a round shape, but inside the shape has blueberries, like blueberries. Nice.
So it's not when you break it open.
Is it a vine?
No. Has probably in that ball shape, in the round shape, has probably 20 berries.
Okay. It's like a spathe, where you have kind of a skin layer on the outside, like a jack in the pulpit.
Almost looks like a blueberry.
Right. And is this a climbing plant? Or
Yes, a climbing plant. The climbing plant. Yep. It's like a vine, you know.
Yep. Get us a picture in when you know of that structure, and we'll take a look at it. I'm sure somebody will have an answer for it.
We'll be able to find
it. We kind of pass it around many of the ag agents or the extension agents around the state and a few of the specialists, and come up with a pretty good synopsis of what it may be.
Okay, I should take a picture from it. You know, I still have the plant. Actually, I still have a piece of it. You know, from the fruit and from last year.
It comes back every year.
Yeah, it comes back every year. Every year, but in the same spot, you know. I got numerous plants like this.
Well, I'll tell you what, it'd be interesting. Take some pictures. Get a picture of the leaves.
And also the fruit structure.
And then the fruit.
Okay. Then I have to wait till the fall comes again, you know. But mm-hmm. I got the fruit I have, you know, I still have from last year. But no leaves, you know.
Yeah.
No leaves.
All right. Well, good luck, and I'm curious to know. So is Bob. So send off those pictures when you get the chance, Adolf. Thank you very much for calling. You can join in, too, with your gardening question at 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us at talk@wpr.org. And we'd love to... love to hear from you. Anything come across your desk in the way of new varieties, vegetable varieties, or flower varieties, Bob?
Well, this is the time to be looking at those garden catalogs.
Yeah.
There's plenty coming in, and I really encourage people to take a look and read some of the descriptions. Of course, select those vegetable varieties or fruit varieties that you will eat. It's no reason for planting things that aren't going to be consumed by you and your family. But some interesting things coming along in the broccoli, and we might even have a demonstration of this at the research stations, is that normally many of the broccolis were developed for a single head harvest. Now they've got some varieties that they're selecting now that you harvest that first head, and the axillary buds produce four or five heads that are just about the same size.
Oh.
So for somebody with some plants in the backyard, might be something to look at. One example of a variety like that would be Diplomat, and that's one to take a look at. One of the things I'm also curious to look at is the floret size, because the finer the florets, usually the better the flavor that you have with the broccoli. So that's kind of interesting coming in. With some of the pole-type beans, and we've always had two or three varieties, and there are some catalogs like Johnny Selected Seeds and some of the other ones that will actually carry these shorter season varieties of plant materials that will ripen up if you happen to be in northern Wisconsin. And I think that's something really worth looking at. We had a watermelon trial this last year, and we call those refrigerator-friendly. In other words, you take one watermelon that's usually between 3 and 6 pounds and it would fit right on the shelf of your refrigerator. You don't have to take out two shelves to get it in there. It's about one meal's worth. And there's gaining interest in the fresh market industry for that one. So we trialed several of those, and we had some interesting data. Although when we looked at those, I had two varieties that did not ripen at the Spooner Research Station, which tells me, okay, we're too far north. Our growing season isn't going to allow that to happen. But that's all part of the research that we do, the applied research.
Absolutely. Frank in Cedarburg, it's your turn now. Let's go there. Hi, Frank.
I have a question. I intend to mix my own fertilizer this come spring, and I want to use bone meal now. How long will bone meal be effective during the growing session?
Okay, what you're talking about is possibly using some of the organic materials
yes,
that are available. Usually the materials like that contain either phosphorus or potassium, which, you know, bone meal and some of those things will last a fairly long period of time. It's when the water comes in contact with that product, when it's in the soil, it makes it available to the plant. Now, when it comes to some of the nitrogen products, like when we talk about blood meal and some of those types of things, there it's a little bit different. Sometimes it's available to the plant material. You get a heavy rain, it might even leach down. And so usually side dressing is always a good option.
Mm-hmm.
With any of those products, you're going to receive a little more bang from your buck.
Okay.
And I suggest doing some side dressing about every 3 weeks or so, and you'll see a definite change in the growth of the plants that you're doing that to.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call. And Ruth in Eagle River up next. Ruth, hello to you.
Hi.
Thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
I have two questions, one about a cactus and one about an aloe plant. The cactus, I believe I've had it for about 7 or 8 or 9 years, I believe. And when I bought it, it was probably about as big as your index finger. Well, now it's 2 feet, 5 inches tall, and it's only about 1 3/4 inch wide, and it just does nothing but keep growing taller. It doesn't really get it much fatter. And I don't really know what kind of cactus it is, but I've tried to look it up and try to find more out about it. And I was wondering if I cut it off, if it would branch out like the kind you see like on the Western movies, you know, like two more parts coming up, and or what could I do with it? It just keeps getting taller and taller, and sometimes it kind of falls over, so I have to have a stick in there.
Yep.
And,
well, it's hard telling what type of cactus. In fact, it may not even be a cactus. There are some other succulent plants that are labeled as cactus.
It's got six sides and six parts that stick out, you know.
Yep. What I would suggest doing is, if you want, send me a digital picture, because I know somebody that's a connoisseur of cacti, and he's always collecting, and I can pass it on to him. Maybe we can come up with a name for it, or send a digital picture to your extension office. They'll get it down to me. That'll help that out. And then your aloe plant?
Oh, yes. My aloe plants, they seem to purge themselves. They push themselves up out of the dirt, and they just kind of lay there, and their roots and everything are exposed. And I don't know why they do that.
Well, part of it is an aloe plant is actually kind of a rhizomatous structure, which means that it wants to grow right at the soil surface, just like an iris or something like that. And so it's going to kind of – the roots that are – if you look carefully, there probably are some roots right at the bottom of that stem-like structure, and that's what's forcing it up.
Uh-huh.
And it's just the growth habit that they happen to
have. That's the way they are. That's the way they are. Ruth, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Oh, we might have an answer to our vine question of a bit earlier. Charlotte in McConnell, Illinois is...
Yes, hello.
Hi.
I'm pretty sure the vine he's talking about is in that S-M-I-L-A-X, Smilax family.
Yep.
And one of them is a terrible briar, you know, has terrible little thorns on them. But he didn't mention the thorns. And the fruiting one, I have the same thing. The birds plant them.
Yep.
So you usually have more than one. And if he opens them up inside, he'll have beautiful, tiny little red, maroon-colored seeds. They look like little jewels.
Yep, and that's sometimes called a green briar because there's a little thorn by each leaf.
Yes. Now, mine doesn't have the thorns. And so I know there's different varieties.
Yep.
So you already answered that. I don't know.
No, I didn't.
I've been on the phone for a while here.
I'll be honest, I was stumped with that one.
Okay, call it green briar.
That's another common name for it.
Yeah, I know there's different varieties out there, and mine don't have any thorns at all. So, and he didn't mention thorns, so.
No, so Smilax.
All right, and the birds love them. I have a cardinal that sits on our porch railing and eats them now this time of the year, even though they have sunflower seeds. And the birds spread the seeds when they sit on telephone wires or fences.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Charlotte. Appreciate your call. Good response there, and it's probably a pretty good guess on that. Bob Tomesch, senior lecturer in the Department of Horticulture at the UW-Madison and UW Extension, our guest today. I'm Larry Mueller. Jim Packard, our producer here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Just relating to that last call, the Smilax is S-M-I-L-A-X, and if our earlier caller went online and typed in Smilax, you're going to see a bunch of pictures and you're going to have some opportunity maybe to identify that.
Right, and if you go to the university herbarium, they have pictures at different stages.
Yeah, absolutely. Good place to go. 1-800-642-1234, our number if you want to join in. Give us a call. We've got open lines. We'll get you on pretty quickly. Mary in Lebanon, it's your turn. Hi, Mary.
Hi. What I'm wondering about, and answer my question, and it was 2 years ago my brother got a trial packet of seeds. It was a butternut variety of squash that was a more compact plant. And I know there were two different varieties they got in the university, I believe, was testing, and I wondered, we really had good luck with the plants, but I don't know the name of the variety of butternut.
Well, what do you think, Bob?
Well, I know who did the testing.
Okay.
You did the testing.
No, it wasn't me.
No.
It probably came out of Racine, Kenosha area.
I don't really know. I mean, my brother's in Madison, so I just, you know, they'd gotten the packets, and they were looking for people to test them. That's all I remember.
Yep. It's possible. The person that did the testing or was doing that for us is now out in North Dakota. Apparently it wasn't cold enough here in Wisconsin. But I couldn't tell you exactly what it was, because I don't remember those trials. He was kind of dealing with those trials. He'd pick certain varieties and that type of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Do you remember his name?
I'll think of it in a minute.
We'll come up with his name, and you could probably Google him.
Oh, okay.
And
I liked is the plants were more compact. I mean, because my brother really planted them close together, and they were, you know, were very productive, and we really had a lot of good squash. But of course, this past year wasn't a good squash year.
Tell you what, Baba's going to ponder this. So you stay listening, Mary. Okay,
okay, I will.
Right. And I know what he was trying to do that time is because as some of the bush type, that's some new squash varieties for those people that have limited garden space. And they tend to have shorter inner nodal lengths.
Okay.
And so they're almost similar to a zucchini. They spread out a little bit more.
Right.
And some of the first plant materials that came out like that probably 15 years ago had very poor flavor, but they've improved the vegetable characteristics, and I think that's what he was shooting for.
Right. Well, whatever we got, they were really good because, I mean, my brother couldn't use them all, and I certainly enjoyed them too.
Yeah. Wonderful.
Okay. Thank you.
You know, thanks very much for calling. You know, on, what was it, last Friday maybe, the garden, or maybe two Fridays ago on Garden Talk show, a caller with diabetes said she was worried about all the newer vegetable varieties because they're constantly making them sweeter, and she used carrots as an example. And I sent that off to Sue Nitsky, who then contacted another researcher who was actually preparing a paper on that, the chemistry of carrots. And she said, there isn't much that's changed. The carbohydrate content on carrots hasn't changed very much. Energy content's gone from 42 to 43 calories per 100 grams. Carbohydrate from 9.3 to 10.1 gram per 100. So She does say her best advice is to eat a variety of vegetables, and if a person is diabetic, monitoring blood glucose and insulin under the direction of a doctor, you should do that. And some doctors actually do limit carrot consumption in their diabetic patients, but they're very healthy. They're more healthy than they were 50 years ago, as a matter of fact.
Right, they're less fiber.
They're much more nutritious than they were 50 years ago.
But I can see where her concern comes in. I've done sugar content in tomatoes, and that ranges anywhere from three, we call it bricks because it's a combination of both the acid and the sugars, from three all the way up to seven. And those types that are the paste types, like the Roma and some of those, tend to have higher sugar content. And I had someone, we were doing a trial up in the Ashland area, again, trying to select some early maturing varieties.
Yeah.
And we had some of those in the trials, and somebody says, oh, I love tomatoes. I have them for breakfast and everything else. And he says, And when I started sharing the data with the sugar, he says, well, that's why my sugar content is spiking. So some of the more watery types like the beefsteak and some of those will have less sugar content than some of the others. And just kind of stay away from the pear-shaped ones if you happen to be a diabetic.
Okay. Virge in Sturgeon Bay, it's your turn. Hi, Virge.
Hi, Larry. Thanks for taking my call. Sure. Love the show, as always.
Thank you.
I have a question about citrus fruit. I'm trying to cultivate a samsura orange, a lemon, and a lime as bonsai trees. How do I get them to produce fruit? The orange tree actually produced one orange this year, but it never really matured.
Yep.
Well, part of the reason it didn't mature is because it probably didn't have enough vascular tissue to get all the nutrients up to that larger fruit, because what you're doing is stunting the tree. Also, when you're doing that pruning activity that you're doing to keep it in the bonsai shape, sometimes that causes a problem in terms of keeping it in a juvenile state rather than the older adult stage, and so it's less apt to flower and fruit. So,
well, I've been to some bonsai competitions where they actually have the very small trees and then a normal-sized fruit hanging from them, and they're spectacular. But how do you do that?
Well, some of it has also to do with photoperiod and light intensity. Our problem here in Wisconsin, I mean, you can get them to fruit because we had some in the greenhouse one time, but our light intensity is sometimes not strong enough to stimulate flower formation, and I think some of those start flowering as early as February and March. And our weakest light happens to be in December. So I would check with your bonsai group and see if they have some literature on that. I'm guessing they even have some specific selections of lemons and those types of things. That
Varieties, you mean.
Right, yeah. That will work. That's about all I can tell you on that.
All right.
All right, thanks much.
Yep, thanks, Bert. Mike in Coon Valley, on to you now. Hi, Mike.
Good morning. I've got a raspberry patch. It's probably about 12 years old, and last year it really got hit hard by the blight that affects them. So I want to eliminate that patch and put in some new plants this spring. Do I have to move the line of raspberries if I plow these under, mow them off, plow them under, or can I keep them in the same area in our garden?
Well, the problem with keeping in the same area of your garden, even though you plow and till it up, there are always going to be some shoots from those old varieties coming up. And so you're going to have an intermixing of varieties. That's going to be one problem, but sometimes those diseases that they carry will remain in the root segments or whatever, and then as that new plant grows, it's going to carry it with it. So I would suggest moving to another area and then definitely killing out the raspberries. It's going to take a good year, from my experience, mm-hmm. to do that by regular tilling and that and just knocking down the vegetation and start with an entirely new plot. And there's some very good ones out there, some things for you to think about when it comes to raspberries is maybe select one that's a fairly early maturing, early variety, so you have fruit early on. There's some of those like June or Boyne, and then there's later season, Latham, which is an old standby, and there are some newer ones that come about. Purples are in between, and then our fall bearing Autumn Bliss, Autumn Britain, they start fruiting as early as about the 10th of August. So any good raspberry grower should have fruit from about the 1st of July all the way up until we have some heavy frost in the fall.
Okay, what about the ones that they say you mow them off in the fall and they'll sprout back up in the spring? Are those going to be as hardy as something that you leave the cane stand?
Yes, because what you're doing is you're mowing them off to the ground. That primal cane, when it comes up, when it gets to a certain height, it's going to flower and start fruiting, and that cane will actually flower that season. So you're only growing canes 1 year each time.
Okay.
So that's a good thing.
Yep, and there's some very good varieties. Autumn Bliss, Autumn Britain, Polaina are just some examples of varieties I would definitely look at.
Okay.
All right, thanks a lot for calling, Mike. Appreciate it. You mentioned tomatoes earlier, Bob. What's the difference between someone's emailing here? The difference between determinate and indeterminate tomatoes, and which are the best to plant in Wisconsin's climate?
Well, it's not which is best to plant, what you're going to use them for. Best example of an indeterminate is one that continues to grow. Our cherry tomatoes would be probably the most one most people would be most common familiar with. It just keeps growing vine and growing vine. They all have some larger fruited ones that they grow in commercial greenhouses for production. So those are the indeterminate types. The determinate types get about so tall, and then they have a flush of flowers, usually near the top, and they'll have a whole fruit set at one time. And for canning purposes, it's nice because you have all your fruit within a period of about 10 or 14 days, and you always have some laggers before and after.
Right.
But you have that flush of fruit for harvesting, and so that's the determinate type. Many of the larger fruited ones that we would grow will probably fall in that category. So the cherries tend to be the indeterminate types.
Laura in Blue River, it's your turn next. Hi, Laura.
Hi, Larry and Bob. First, I've got a question about beans, but first I'd like to warn people that the plant sold in catalogs as Tall Hedge is buckthorn. Miller's, Henry Fields, and Gurney's sell that as Tall Hedge, and they don't say anything that it's buckthorn, but that's what it is. My question about beans is I'm looking for a mosaic resistant bush bean, and nobody says whether they're mosaic resistant, and I haven't seen anything for that.
You're gonna have to shop around a little bit on that one. One of the problems with some of the beans is that we end up getting is they start out disease free. But when we have a flush of insects, and many times when they start cutting alfalfa hay, those insects move from the hay on, or we even get flights that come out of the southern states of some of the leafhoppers. They'll bring some of these along. So I'm guessing that's where that's probably coming from.
Yeah.
We have a publication. It's the Vegetable Varieties. It should be online. I think we kind of regenerated that one. It kind of went into dormancy for a while. And that'll list some varieties. And I haven't looked at it, or I don't have a copy with me, but you might see mosaic resistance in there.
And where's that found?
That should be in the University of Wisconsin Publications under Vegetables.
In the Extension Publications?
Yes.
Right.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Here's another email. Would you have some suggestions for relatively fast-growing hedges or bushes that can be planted along a fence that would grow quickly vertically in order to provide a visual barrier to the neighboring yard?
Well, we've always got lilac, you know. That's one that comes along pretty quite rapidly, and it's fairly dense. So that's always a fairly good standby. Some of the other faster growing ones, but they're not as thick in terms of the shrubbery, would be some of the viburnums, which would take care of that problem. So that would be another group to take a look at. There are some of the gooseberry selections, so would be possibilities. There's a very good publication that's called Selecting Woody Landscape Plants for Wisconsin, and in there are a list of shrubs that you might want to take a look at. Depending on the soil you have, if you have heavier soils, you might even want to look at some of the dogwoods to fill that bill. But you want to get something that are in the taller shrub category, and that publication should list several that will take care of that.
And that's a UW extension.
That's another UW extension.
Okay. Kathy and Bruce, we'll go to you now. Hi, Kathy.
Yes, recently our garden club got together and we made rain barrels, and I was really excited about it until I get down in the literature and it says, do not use it coming off of a roof for any of your vegetable garden. I thought, oh, that's what I wanted it for. Yeah. Is there any way, it's not good for coming off a roof? What are we picking up off of it, or can it be tested? Or
I'm not familiar with that
problem.
Problem.
I don't know. I mean, I hadn't heard it either, and even with the internet research I'd done, and when I got to that line, I went, oh, okay. You know, what am I getting off an asphalt roof?
Well, sometimes you get dust particulates or those types of problems, but
it shouldn't hurt.
Would have to see the publication and take a look at it and see where it warrants.
You had a zinc strip on the roof, maybe?
There's no zinc strip. In fact, I was going to put on a new roof and was going to put a zinc strip on, but I thought, no, now I won't, but there's no copper, there's no zinc. I guess there's aluminum soffits, but it's vinyl. It's vinyl gutters.
Yep. And I don't see a problem. We have a research project going on at the old J. Knorr where they're collecting rainwater and seeing how much they can utilize for some irrigation projects out there. And so I'd have to talk with John Steyer, who's doing that research, to see if he's come across anything.
As far as we know, shouldn't be a problem.
No. Nope.
Should be fine. But thank you very much. Mm-hmm.
But thanks. We're always open to learning, you know.
Yeah, that's right. Marion in Windsor, we're on to you now. Hi, Marion.
Hi. I have a rain barrel. Actually, it's not a barrel. It's a 50-gallon agriculture type of bin that I collect the rain from my roof, and I've been using it for vegetables and flowers for many years, and I don't see any problem. I don't know if I'm not doing myself good by what's in there, but they don't seem to. It sure doesn't kill the plants anyway.
I'm not sure what the issue was, that she was bringing up either.
Okay, and then I've had trouble growing carrots. They don't seem to get very straight, and it takes forever for them to get big. Maybe I am not growing shorter day one. But
okay, let me ask you how you prepare your garden. Do you use a rototiller?
Yes.
Okay, a rototiller, what it does is when the tines come down, only beats the soil, loosens the soil for a depth of maybe 2 inches or 3. Carrot is much deeper. Where you're going to place your carrot row, I'd take a spade in there and get it down a good 8 inches and loosen that soil up. You probably have such a hard pan that when that taproot of the carrot starts growing down in there, it hits that hard soil and it even grows horizontally or stymies the growth. And so for some of those types of root crops, it's a good idea.
Yeah. Oh,
okay, thank you.
All right, thanks a lot for calling. You could even start with a rototiller and
Till
it
up.
Go with that and then shovel afterwards.
The other thing that happens, and she was at a farm site, sometimes if they use animal manures that aren't, and they apply the animal manures, and what happens then is that during the nitrification or the breakdown of that has an impact on the development of taproots as well. So I should have asked her that one. But the rototiller is a quite common problem with growing carrots.
All right. Deborah in Rice Lake, your turn now. Hi, Deb.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have some very old apple trees, and I was wondering if there's something I can use to spray for bugs that would be chemical-free.
Well, you'd have to look at – you're talking about coming in with some type of organic management. You have some options there. There's some information on called bagging apples where you take a you can either buy the bags or you can take some Ziploc bags, sandwich bags, cut the corner off and slip it on that fruit when they're about the size of a dime, and then the fruit will develop inside of the bag. I usually use a hand staple on each side. Then you don't have any insects or diseases that come in contact really don't hit the fruit. And that project was really developed and expanded at the University of Minnesota, and it's been fairly successful. I've tried it here.
And it works.
There are some organic types of sprays like Bordeaux mixture and some of the horticultural oils. With any of these, what you're doing is providing a protection. And you need to apply that protection after every heavy rain because it washes off that protectant. And so you're talking about spraying maybe 12 times during the growing season to give you the protection that you need. So that's why people.
What is that called? How do you spell it?
Which one?
Bordeaux
is Bordeaux. Bordeaux.
Oh, okay.
And you can find those at garden centers. It's a copper sulfate material that falls in the organic category. There's horticultural oil. There's horticultural oil and then there's dormant oil. Don't use the dormant oil because that'll actually burn leaf tissue once it gets going. And some of the horticultural oils are very fine, refined types of oils that will not damage the leaf tissue. There are also some sulfur products that are out there. So there are some if you want to try an organic approach or just simply bag the apples. You can bag about 40 or 50 an hour. And Larry, how many apples do you eat in a year?
Well, I eat quite a few, but not
100? 200?
I probably would eat somewhere around 200.
Okay, you could be done in 5 hours, and then you could use the other, let's see, 24 hours in a growing season. You could probably use the other 19 for fishing.
There you go. Well, thank you very much.
And promise me, Deborah, that you'll try that for at least on a few of the apples.
And if they turn out really good, you're supposed to send us a dozen, right?
Oh, okay.
But
will do.
Try it on at least a few just to see what you get. You're going to be surprised.
I've done the apple thing here at the research stations, and I've been very impressed with it. It just takes a little bit of time.
No?
Mm-hmm.
Thanks, Deb.
Thank you so much.
Mm-hmm. Dennis in Sun Prairie. Hello.
Hi. Say, last fall I constructed a trellis, and I would like to grow peaches on it in a spalliard type of arrangement. I'm looking for suggestions.
Well, when it comes to peaches, we're right at the edge of the growing area. That's one problem. The other problem, we have what's called peach leaf curl. And you can start out with disease-free plant materials, but it seems like those fungi get in there and it causes a curl leaf. And there's a very good X-File bulletin at the University Extension on peach leaf curl if you have that problem. Okay, when it comes to hardiness on peaches, it's a challenge. Reliance is fairly... I'm going to give you three selections that if you're going to try, keep your fingers crossed, you might get some fruit. Reliance, Madison, and then there's the Har series, H-A-R, like Har... There's Harcot apricots. There's the Harlow Diamond or some of those types of things that have come out of the... breeding program in Canada, and it usually has H-A-R on the names. You're going to have to really shop around because last year I was looking for some of those. I couldn't find any, although a couple of years ago I did, but they're there, just a matter of finding them on the internet.
How many, and I assume that I should look for bare root stock, and I guess on my trellis is about probably 10, 12 foot long. How many plants should I put in there?
Well, you can really intensively manage those. I would put no more than three.
Okay.
And, we just finished our fruit conference this last week, and we had a speaker from Michigan who was talking about, we're going to start growing. Someday apples will be grown just like we grow grapes on a trellis. And there in Europe, they were planting those plants a foot apart. There are some successful growers in Michigan. They have just planted 1,000 acres with a spacing of about 18 inches on apples.
Whoa! Oh,
and they have fruit at about 3 and 4 years. And they're designed with intensive pruning. In this country, we probably let them grow to a height of about 12 feet because we have hydraulic stuff. In Europe, they only go at about 8 feet. So they can harvest all the fruit. They can't afford to pay for the labor of harvesting and management, and so they've gone with a strictly smaller statured tree, and they do this all by pruning.
Boy.
So life is changing out there, even in the apple orchard.
All right. Thanks, Dennis. Thanks very much for calling. Bob Tomesch, Senior Lecturer in the Department of Horticulture with UW-Madison and UW-Extension, our guest here on Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. If you have an outdoor gardening question or maybe a tree question, a bush question, a lawn question, I hope you'll join us here at 800-642-1234 or email us at talk@wpr.org. Larry Mueller here with Bob Tomesch. And Bob, we have a call from Paul in Cascade. So let's go there. Hi, Paul.
Good morning.
Morning.
I'm a vegetable gardener who uses raised beds,
mm-hmm.
and a rototiller. I get very good results. I can get down to 8 inches easily with my tiller. It's the little Mantis tiller that I can pick up and put in the bed. I have no problem with going down 8 inches.
So you're addressing the issue we had with the carrots?
Yes.
Yeah, in each soil, you've probably amended your soil, so you've got plenty of organic matter and stuff
constantly.
Like that in it. But in a typical garden where we're talking about maybe 3% or less organic material, depending on the soil types we have in some parts of the state, if we have any heavier types of soil, where that tine comes down and comes, you know, only reaches so deep, it almost has a little compacted layer, and that's what we're trying to address in that discussion.
I'm aware of that problem, yeah. That's one reason why I got the Mantis tiller. In another area, could you mention your friend who is the cactus guru or expert?
Well, I'm not going to mention. What I'll do is if you get the picture to me, I will pass it on to him, and he collects cacti.
Okay.
He's not an extension guy or extension relating to that.
So, he is in Wisconsin, though?
He's in Wisconsin, yes.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. And what's your have you got an email address, Bob?
It's just rjtomesh@wisc.edu.
rjtomesh@wisc.edu. All right. There you have it. Chet in Monroe Center. On to you now. Hi, Chet.
Good morning.
Morning.
The reason I'm calling is we're wondering about the leaching of the plastic when you would put it over all those apples and it's sitting out in the sun. You know, they talk about leaching in your water and water bottles and stuff like that. So I was wondering about that end of things.
Well, I haven't picked up anything on that, on the leaching part. I haven't got any data on that part, but we haven't had any issues with it as yet. And also the plastics do vary from one product to the next. But these have been used for probably decades, these types of plastics. In Japan, they've developed one that's in a paper bag with a plastic liner in it. And they pull the paper bag off the last 3 weeks so the fruit will color up. If you leave it in a paper bag, it's kind of a greenish-yellow, and that's all that develops because we need the sunlight to trigger the reds and those types of things. So I would have no information on that. It may be a possibility, but I don't have any data.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks for calling. Bill in Shiocton, your turn. Hi, Bill.
Good morning. Well, I had one comment when I started, and then I heard that last call. I worked for a company that made plastic bags for many years. And first of all, Ziploc is a brand, not a type of bag. And it has a premium closure. You pay a premium price for it. So instead of recommending Ziploc, I would recommend a sandwich bag.
Okay. I've fought that battle with every type that there is out there.
Okay.
And I will tell you why I've gone to that type with the zipper on top, because there's a thicker plastic there. And when I, not that I zip it up, but when I put the staple in, I put it on the inside of it and it lasts better. When I go to sandwich bags, you know, where there's no thicker plastic and you put it and you put a staple on either side of the stem, just due to wind damage and that, I lost more bags per hundred than I did with the other ones. That's the only reason I've gone
through. It might be good to clarify that when you're speaking of it. Because what you're really looking for, I think, is a thicker plastic.
Right.
That's right.
And you can find that on the package.
Yes, that's right. Good points. Thanks.
Okay, I'd like to say something, too, about leaching.
Okay.
Sandwich bags are made under very strict FDA standards, and they're made from polyethylene. So they do not have these plasticizers in them that are a problem with other stiffer plastics like plastic water bottles.
Okay.
So I would have very little concern along those lines.
That's a good point. Thank you, Bill.
You're welcome.
Appreciate that very much. Good points. You can join us at 1-800-642-1234 or email us at talk@wpr.org. Let's go to Tom in Antioch, Illinois. Tom, hello.
Hello there. My question today is, I want to grow hops, and living in Antioch, I want to know, you know, first, can it be done, and what do I need in order to do that?
Yes, it can be done. You need to find a source of seeds, and you need to build a trellis so you have something to grow them on. The problem, one issue, or one challenge, let's call it a challenge here in Wisconsin, is that they are very disease susceptible, and they'll pick up powdery mildews and a few other things. But yes, they do grow hops. We have some out at one of the research stations. But most of the hop growing, even though the beer industry is still strong in Wisconsin and always has been, a lot of the hop industry has moved to drier climates like Washington, Oregon, and California, where they do not have the humidity and the disease problems.
And if you're a beer maker, you'll know that the price of hops
is really high.
Is really, really high because of the problems growing hops out west,
right,
northwest.
And the other issue, we had this discussion at lunch the other night. we had some professors in speaking, some from Michigan and from Maine and a few other places were sitting around, and that topic of hops came up. And one person who has ancestry in Europe said that, well, we need to take a look at what Europe has for varieties because they grow hops in Germany in places that are as humid as Wisconsin and if not more, and they're having success. So maybe we need to look at some of that germplasm. So there may be some hope in the future. But, yes, you can grow hops here. I would pick a real sunny, open place where you get good air movement through there so you don't have to apply any pesticides.
Well, I have a real sunny place. It's along a fence on the property that I just exposed last summer. So I was hoping that along there I could build the trellises to grow them.
Yep. Yep. And if you go shopping in the garden catalogs, you'll see hops. I've seen them already.
Yep.
Yeah. All right. And when's the best time to plant?
Well, you'd always ask me those difficult questions. I've never dabbled with that one. So you'd have to do a little research on your own on that one.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you very much.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call, Tom. On to Bob in Grand Marsh. Bob, hi to you.
Hello. I've got a question about squash bugs.
Okay.
Now, I've got about a 3/4-acre garden plot. I've been working this thing about 16 years. And up until about 3 years ago, I never had a problem with these buggers. And, boy, they've come in the last 2 years in particular. They're on the squash, they're on the pumpkins, they're on the gourds, they're on the melons, they're on everything. What in the world can I do to get rid of these things?
Okay, you're talking about the insects with the little black spots or the stripes on it?
Well, I don't know. These are kind of grayish color.
Oh.
Maybe they aren't squash bugs, but they're just everywhere, and they'll get on the vines, and pretty soon the leaves are dying off on it, and then pretty soon the plant's done.
Did you say gray or green?
They're kind of grayish color.
Gray, okay.
Kind of about 3/4 inch long?
Yeah, I'd say they're about.
Yeah, you probably have squash vine borer. The reason the population is increasing is that they overwinter in the soil, and so once you start, they keep increasing and increasing. You're almost going to have to look at utilizing some type of insecticide management, whether it's organic or inorganic. And if you watch very carefully, you can catch when the adult flight is. And usually in the Department of Ag and then also the publication that I do on a weekly – or printing I do on a weekly basis, the Wisconsin Horde Update, we try to monitor when our heat units get such that the adults start emerging from the soil, and there's about a 3-week window in there where most of the eggs are laid. And they will usually lay their eggs within a couple feet of where the vine goes into the ground, and they'll usually pick a spot close to where a leaf comes out. And where they lay the egg, and where you see the wilting, it's kind of interesting, is that the larvae then, once it hatches, crawls in and starts burrowing, and so it disrupts the vascular tissue. By 3 o'clock in the afternoon, your vines look kind of wilty.
Yep.
Next morning, they look great. Yeah. And you go through that for about a week, and then they die. And that's probably what you got. So.
Is there something does 7 work on that, or is there something I can spray to get rid of these things?
Yeah, I would get, there's a bulletin on squash vine borer, and I would get that one.
Okay.
Part of it is the timing is very crucial, and also when we're dealing with that vine borer, we're also dealing with some flowering that might be beginning to occur, and then we have to deal with the protection of our honeybees, and so the timing of the application and the product we use and the time of day is quite crucial.
Okay. All right, thank you.
All right, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Denise has a large supply of horse manure emailing us here. Can I start a compost pile on the corner of the lean-to and get it to work at this time of year? I'd like to get a head start on making compost for the garden.
Well, there's a 50-gallon rain barrel, poke a couple holes in the bottom. Yeah, you can possibly get it going. It's a temperature-related. It's kind of cold. You have to get that temperature in there probably up to about 30 degrees or so, 30-some degrees. You could probably cheat to put a little heat in there, like get one of those cables that they use for heating pipes. mm-hmm. and wrap that in there, and that'll get the compost going, and then it'll start generating its own heat. And then keep it moist enough, not overly watered. That's why I said poke a couple holes in the bottom of your container. And the heat from that should generate and keep things going. So there's that. If you go on the internet and do a search on hot, H-O-T, composting, they will have some suggestions on how to speed up the whole compost procedure. And in some situations, if you have enough heat there, they probably will be able to complete it in 14 to 21 days rather than a whole summer growing season.
And Josh from the Lake Superior Research Institute emailed us to say that there is a peach tree that grows and fruits well in northern Wisconsin. He doesn't remember the species, but it's from Siberia, and it seems to handle minus 40 with no problems. He has a friend who has several trees in Hayward for over 10 years.
Those are Siberian apricots.
Oh, Siberian apricots.
Yes, and they are two zone 2, and I've used those for rootstock when I've grafted plums or cherries or peaches once in a while if I want something that's really hardy, because when I've noticed when I've tried dabbling with some of the peaches or apricots in particular, they don't really put it on hardy rootstock, especially when the company that does the propagation is in California. They really don't know what Wisconsin cold is. And so if I'm doing some of my own grafting to get going, I've gone to that Siberian apricot.
Bob Tomesch, Senior Lecturer in the Department of Horticulture with UW-Madison and UW Extension, our guest here on Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. Talking on this edition of Garden Talk with Bob Tomesch, Senior Lecturer at the UW-Madison and UW Extension in the Department of Horticulture. Larry Mueller here, happy to have you listening in. Give us a call with your questions or email us. The email is talk@wpr.org. Call us at 800-642-1234. Bob, got an email wondering if you know the name of the grasses planted along the hillsides of I-94.
I'd only have to guess because I haven't stopped and did, but usually along roadsides and that, they often use the rough fescues because they're very durable. They get to a height of about 10 inches and they kind of stop growing. They're fairly dense and they can tolerate the abuse of drainage and things like that. So my guess would be that it probably has some rough fescue in the mix.
Anne in Iowa County, it's your turn now. Anne, thank you for waiting. Hi.
Good morning. Oh, it's a good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
I live in rural Iowa County. I have about 5.5 acres. Half of it's wooded and half of it's open. So there's quite a different variety of wildlife. The previous owner had about 1.5 acres, 2 acres in lawn grass. And I would like to convert that to something that is more nature and wildlife friendly.
Sure.
There's also a trout stream that runs on the north side of the property, and I would prefer not to have the residue from the lawn grass running down into the stream.
Well, residue, you mean what kind of residue?
Fertilizer or something.
Fertilizers, grass clippings.
Yep. Usually with lawn, just lawn is probably your best stabilizer. And what we often suggest is that if you're next to a stream, not to fertilize or use any pesticides within 100 feet of that stream. So therefore, you now have a turf grass type buffer, and it's going to be very protective. As you talk about, okay, you want to include something else in that area for attracting wildlife, there's a
I would just like to replace the turf grass.
So take it all out. Okay.
With something that's more nature-friendly and something I don't have to mow.
Yeah.
Well, you don't have to mow turf grass, and it only gets so tall and stops, too. If you look at some of the old farm pastures where the cattle aren't grazing anymore, it only gets to a height of about 10 inches, and then it stops growing. It'd probably seed out, and that's about it. It's managing it. Also, there's a bulletin that Scott Craven has put together, Attracting Wildlife, and that might be something you might want to look at.
So a lot of your native, if you want to go with some sort of native prairie plants or that sort of thing, there's certainly opportunities there.
There is. The issue with if you're going to go with native prairie plants, there's quite a bit of work involved. And when the tilling process, you open the soil up to erosion, you already have something holding it there. And they do what's called plugging, P-L-U-G-G-I-N-G, where you purchase plugs of certain native plants and you kind of disturb about a 6-inch circle where you set in that plug, and that'll get established, and eventually the turf grass kind of covers it. Even with prairies in that, about 90 to 95% of the vegetation in prairies happens to be grass. We just don't see it. We see the plants that are above it. But the prairie grasses do fill in a lot of that lower canopy.
Yeah.
Is there anything that's less expensive and less labor-intensive? I know it takes up to 3 to 5 years to get a prairie established, and it's a lot of work.
Yeah. Well, I'd take a look at Scott's. Scott's publication is going to help you out a bit on that.
Yeah,
I think.
And there's some shrubbery you can go with, everything from raspberries to some of the shrubs that produce food for birds and other wildlife. And it's a matter of scattering that and just leaving the lawn. You know, have an area you don't mow. It only gets so tall, and then it'll stop growing.
Okay.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. And do pick up go online to UW Extension Publications. You can get Scott Craven's book on that, too, a booklet. Thanks. Charles in Ingleside, Illinois. On to you now. Hi, Charles.
Good afternoon. I have some land beginning at the water and rises up about 10 or 12 feet above. There's a lot of black humus, you know, really black stuff down there, and then better land up higher. I wonder if I can grow kiwis or maybe some of these apples and peaches you're talking about a few minutes ago in that land anywhere.
Is it already cleared?
It's clear, yeah.
Yeah. You could, well, kiwis are always a challenge because they're kind of borderline of the quality of kiwi that is hardy enough for Wisconsin, Illinois. It's very small fruited.
I can't get them through the winter.
Yep, and even having black dirt isn't going to solve that little problem. Yeah. But what you've got there is probably a very good soil for some of the woody type plants, where you can go with some of the plums and apples, and have fairly good success. Pears are always a good chance. If you're far enough south, you can go with the sour cherries, but you might want to try a sweet cherry or two. There's a couple of like black gold and a couple of others that Stella would be another one that shows a fairly good hardiness. So you've got some options there.
Mm-hmm. Good luck. Thank you very much for calling. And Rick in Milwaukee, your turn. Hi, Rick.
Hi, afternoon to you. I'd like some directions for growing potatoes in a container on a porch. The container's 18 inches deep, 19-inch diameter. I get at least 7 to 8 hours of direct sun a day. I'm wondering if that container's big enough and that's enough sun to begin with.
Okay. You can, yes. And I would... It's a temperature situation. The containers usually heat up. I don't know if they're plastic or something like that. You might want to paint them black.
Okay.
That way you get more heat accumulation, just like the lady last time we did the program had the black tires. Okay. Have drainage in the bottom. You don't want a little frog pond starting down there, so
right.
You want to deal with that. And use some potting soil and then place the plants on a weekly fertilizer program. There are some products out there that... I don't know if I can mention, you know, Miracle-Gro and some of those types of products. And some of the Scotts, I'm sure, has a weekly program where it'll tell you how much to mix up. Now, one of the things when you start with potato tubers, you can't go down to the grocery store. You need to go to a garden center and buy the tubers. Usually those in the grocery store have been treated with something that keeps them from sprouting.
Mm.
So go down to a garden center and buy some tubers. And I had a question for somebody, and I was trying to pick out one that does two things. One, sprouts early, and two, forms tubers at an early age, because I was thinking about trying that little project myself.
Mm-hmm.
And you can start as early as, stuff will start growing. Or you can even cheat, and at night when it's really cold, carry the buckets in or containers into the garage and then set them back out later
mm-hmm.
on.
Okay.
But I'd go with potting soil. I would start out with probably about 4 inches of potting soil or so. Set the plants. As they begin to grow, add more potting soil because it's not a root, but it's actually a stem that produces the tuber. And that stem evolves in the axil of a leaf. And as the vine is up there, a potato vine probably 10 inches, you add another 4 inches of soil, you've covered up some of those leaves, but then there's going to be side shoots, and at the tip of them is where your tuber's going to be. So it's a matter of playing that little role, but you can successfully do it. I talked to somebody last year that planted on Good Friday, and I don't know, that probably was fairly early last year. But anyway, he had potatoes and tubers available for eating in May.
Okay, just one follow-up on that. Do you think 18 inches is deep enough, and how many mini tubers would one place in a container that size, maximum?
At 18-inch wide, I'd put two in there.
No, 19 inches wide, 18 inches deep.
Yeah, but what I'm saying is you start out with 4 inches of soil, and you could probably add another foot of soil on there just as long as you have some green tissue exposed, and that'll give you more tuber formation as long as you keep plenty of water and nutrients there.
And a couple of...
Usually potato tubers we're planting about a foot apart.
I see. But no more than two, you would...
Two or three at a triangle.
Okay, great. Thanks very much.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. Linda has an email question for you. She has an unknown plant. It's a heavy woody vine similar to grape, leaves smooth, heart-shaped across from each other. Clusters of blueberry types in the clusters which sit off the main vine by a heavy wood stem. Haven't seen any type of thorns. Flowers are small and white in May and June. Any ideas there?
Well, I'd have a couple of guesses on it, and then I have to, being that she has alternate leaves, that would help reduce or guess what it might be. A couple of choices. Porcelain plant would be one possibility. And I'd have to look at details on that. I don't have the book here. The other thing, it could be some of the ivies, which have purple clusters on them as well. And it could be one of the smilexes, possibly.
Possibly. Is there another email, this one from David, is there a sweet, juicy pear that's hardy in Rice Lake?
Oh, I'd go with Luscious. Lincoln, or a couple of...
Luscious and Lincoln, okay.
Okay, they're earlier types. When you get to the Bartletts, you should be able to grow them there most years. And with pears, they actually, after you harvest them, when they're in storage, that 3 weeks is when they really ripen up. Some people place them in a bag or in a refrigerator where it's dark. And so pay attention to the harvesting part. The Bartletts are a zone 4, so if we have a severe winter, the flower buds. But I've seen pears all the way across Wisconsin. There are a few others that fall into the hardier categories, but what you want to do is select a variety that ripens earlier, because some of those ripen like sickle and some of the other ones so late.
Yeah.
It's like trying to grow 120-day corn in Rice Lake. It's probably not going to quite happen.
Not going to happen. Bob in Shawano is up next. Bob, hello.
Good afternoon, guys. How are you today?
Great. Thank you for calling.
Good. I have 5 acres of land up here, and it's an abandoned farm field. And I think it's been about 10, 15 years since it's been farmed, and it's just been vacant ever since. And I've been wanting to racking around trying to figure out what kind of trees I'd like to put on it. I'd like to plant some trees on there to try and – I was just wondering, is it – good idea to stick with a pine plantation, or can I go and get various different kinds of trees and plant just miscellaneously around the property? And how would something like that work out?
Well, first of all, I would suggest look at what's growing in the wild right around you, and you get an idea if it's more conifers or the pines, or if it's more the oaks. It depends on the soil, and birch if it happens to be a wetter soil. But that'll give you a little bit of flavor of what was there probably originally. You can intermix the plants, and many people do, because if there's ever a disease that comes through or an insect, you're only eliminating maybe one plant species and not the whole bunch. As for getting plant materials, the cost of woody plants are a choice. The Department of Natural Resources usually has these available, and there's also different nurseries around that supply plant materials. I think there's one up in the Wausau area. You're not too far away from that.
Right.
So you might want to check on the prices of those. And if you get some of the smaller trees that are about a foot tall or so, those will fill out eventually.
Okay. All right. And then so what kind of pine trees would you recommend for something like that?
Well, in your area, the white pine are probably the most prevalent. unless you're in sandier areas, and then you see some of the jack pine. But that would be, and the tamarack or larch is one that's very versatile. And as I heard one forester say, I think we've overlooked that one for years. We always felt that it grew in a marsh area, but it does quite well in dry land situations as well.
Super. That's what I got. Just pretty much sandy, dry area. So
give it a shot.
Look at the trees around you, and that'll give you an idea of what kind of plants were probably there at one time.
I know the neighboring property has some pretty big white pines right now. So
Well, there you go.
White pines would certainly work.
Super. All right. Thank you very much, guys.
Yeah. Thanks, Bob. Jim in St. Croix Falls. Your turn. Hi.
Hi. I have a question about home grafting. I tried grafting years ago and used a pocket knife and didn't have any luck. And I don't know. I heard somewhere that there's newer tools that make it much easier. Is there? Can you talk about that at all?
Yes, there are grafting tools that are available. Some are V-shaped and some have kind of, they call it the Omega. It's kind of like a little horseshoe that make the cuts. I've tried those. I still have the best luck with a good sharp knife or a utility knife because it makes a smooth cut. Many of those grafting tools, what happens if you don't have a sharp enough blade in there, you're actually crushing the cells as, you know, getting it together. Keeping things moist, collecting the cyanwood at the right time of the year, all of those things play a very crucial role. You might want to do just a quick search on the internet on grafting apple trees, and they'll be giving you some hints as to when to do it and when to collect your cyanwood, which is usually in February. You want to select the water sprouts because they're the most vigorous. Pencil-sized diameter is one of the things. Finding appropriate rootstock that you can use, and I often suggest using the dwarfing rootstocks like M9 and Bud9 and some of those things because they're called precocious. In other words, they'll set fruit at an age of about 4 years. Rather, if you use just taking seeds from a regular apple tree, planting them in the ground right away after you eat the apple and it grows up, you're probably going to wait 8-10 years. You know, Larry, you and I, we probably we got to think about that.
Okay, thank you very much.
All right, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. And let's see. Oh, we have Renee in Connersville has a question. Do you have any suggestions for getting rid of spud bugs? I've tried picking them, spraying them with dish detergent, spreading diatomaceous earth on them. None of this works, and I lost most of my crop last summer. Next summer, I'm declaring war on these beetles, and what should I arm myself with?
They're becoming a real challenge because many of them are becoming tolerant or resistant to some of the insecticides that we do have. One thing that you have going for you is that they tend to walk into the garden. They don't fly. Mm-hmm. And a few things that can be done is, and they'll walk from like a tree line or someplace where there's taller grasses. At the Hancock Station where we do our potato research, they come walking out of the shelter belts. It's just like a little army marching out there. And they'll do that when the temperature gets such. Okay, what can you do? There are some pesticides out there. There's a 7 product you might want to look at. There's some insecticidal soaps. And there's also a BT product, and Phil Pelletieri, he can mention it, but it's specifically designed for potato beetle. Most of the BT products are for larvae of moths and butterflies. This one has been selected for that. Getting it on there, and it's a protectant. In other words, once the larvae consume that bacteria, they will parasitize their stomach, their gut, and so it'll kill them. A few other things you can do. Lay a dig kind of a little depression around your on the edge of your garden and put some plastic there down, and they can't crawl up they crawl into the plastic, they fall into the center, and you got them.
You got them.
That's another way. Or use what we call a deterrent plant. At least you can tell when they're showing up, and then you can start picking them off. I don't know how much you have. If you only have one row, you can sometimes get ahead, but they really like some of the other solanaceous types of plants, like eggplant. And that's one, if there's an eggplant in your garden, you have it along the edge, they'll show up there first because they like the odors that are given off by that. And so then you can tell they're there. And sometimes they're attracted to, you can pick it off of that and before they get down to the main potatoes.
Okay. Eric in Oconomowoc, your turn. Hi, Eric.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. I just moved up to Wisconsin this year from Georgia, and I was wondering if you had any advice on, Wisconsin weather, starting out a garden this summer for someone that's not real used to things like frost and other.
Well, maybe after next week, you might want to move back. A few of the things. What part of Wisconsin are you?
Oconomowoc.
Oconomowoc. Oh, you're down in the banana belt down here. A few of the things. Usually with gardening, there are cool season and warm season crops. The cool season would be the radishes and spinaches and some of those types of things. And onions. You can plant right after the soil thaws, and you can get in the garden and work. You don't want to work the soil too early. Those will grow. When it comes to our warm season crops, which would be beans and all of our tomatoes and all those, down in this part of the state, we usually figure around Mother's Day, 15th of May, chances of frost are pretty well past, and you can plant those crops. Our frost-free season down here is a lot longer. You go from probably mid-May to almost the 1st of October.
I usually wait on peppers, though, until into June.
Peppers are, okay, when we start looking at the tomato plants, will start growing at about 50 degrees Fahrenheit. Peppers wait till about 60 degrees, and the same thing with our squashes and some of those plants. So you want to wait till the soil temperature, and last year that soil temperature didn't get there till the 17th of June.
Yeah, and you'll get plants, but you won't get peppers if you.
They only grow when it's really warm, and then they sit there, and they grow a little bit, and then they sit there until you get the warmer temperatures.
And there are some really good extension publications, so I hope you're going to go to University of Wisconsin Extension publications, and you'll get a whole bunch of things on growing vegetables in Wisconsin.
Yep, a very good source.
Well, thank you very much. Look forward to the summer then.
Yeah, that's all we can do is look forward to it now and hope for that it'll come eventually.
Look at those garden catalogs tonight, you know.
Oh, boy, we got some really cold temperatures coming our way, I guess, I'm told, next week. Tony and Barron, your turn. Hi, Tony.
Yes, hi. My daughter moved to South Carolina, and I fell in love with holly plants. And I tried to bring them back a couple times, and they keep dying on me, even within the house. But I hear there are some varieties that will grow in Wisconsin. I was wondering if you had any suggestions.
Well, there are a couple that they grow in Wisconsin. Okay, let's back up. You're talking about the ones with they have little indentations on the leaves, almost look like oak leaves?
Right.
Yeah.
And the red berries.
Yeah. Those are like zone 5. Barren isn't quite there.
No.
But there are some wild holly that do grow up in the area. If you ever drive around, you see along those marshes, you see kind of the red berries. That's an ilex variety. And those could be planted with the red fruit on those. And they come in male and female. And so when you're purchasing, you want to buy one of each if you look in the garden catalog. I think it's Ilex verticillata. And but look in the garden catalogs, any one of like the Wisconsin garden catalogs and some of those that are out there from some of the nurseries here in Wisconsin, they will have that one. So if you want to try growing a holly, that's about the only one you can grow.
Okay.
All right.
Okay. Thank you.
Thanks very much for calling. And in about 30 seconds, can you explain how to grow stevia? Doris wonders.
Can't. That was fast.
Well, there's no issue there.
No, I'd have to do a little work on that one.
All right. What about could you treat scale on a small moth orchid?
Yes, scale are always a real challenge because they're close to the ground, are close to the plant tissue, and they sometimes secrete on top of themselves so they're protected. I would go into a garden center and see what they have for product, and they will actually not only give you the product, but they should tell you how to utilize that product, even though it's on the label.
Makes good sense.
Some hints.
Bob, always a pleasure. You'll be back on February 6th.
Yeah, we
about
that,
a month.
Picked that date as we sat here.
All right. Bob Tomesch, senior lecturer in the Department of Horticulture at UW-Madison and UW Extension. Of course, we have a garden talk every week, but in about a month, February 6th, Bob will be back and we'll deal with him again, and he'll deal with you. let's look forward to that. And thank you for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Net.